May it please the court, my name's Greg Pivovar. I'm counsel for Marcus De La Torre in this particular case. This case primarily focuses on an insufficiency of evidence argument, denial of the motion for judgment of acquittal. Mr. De La Torre was charged with three charges. Count one was conspiracy to distribute 500 grams of methamphetamine. Count two was possession with intent on August 24th, 2015. And count three, that one was the earlier 2014 possession with intent. And count three was possession with intent on August 24th, 2015. Mr. De La Torre owned a car repair body shop contained within a building that had another business contained in it, which was a mechanical repair shop. In the 2014 incident, that, and I'll refer to that as the Slavicek incident. He and Ryan Slavicek were stopped in a vehicle right shortly after Mr. De La Torre entered that vehicle. They had driven a short distance from his place of employment, and they were testing the car, more or less. He had been in the car. He was driving the vehicle. They were stopped. Officer Holt Meyer of the Omaha Police Department stopped them, and they noticed some nervousness in Mr. Slavicek. Mr. Holtmeyer said Mr. Slavicek was nervous, breathing heavily. He indicated that he was the owner of the vehicle. His uncle was the owner of the vehicle. At that time, it was also disclosed later on that the vehicle had in fact been parked in front of Mr. Slavicek's girlfriend's house, who was a known drug dealer. Contraband was eventually found in the center console of the car. Mr. De La Torre remained in the car while Mr. Slavicek exited the car.
So what's the fatal... I understood your argument to be a lack of evidence. What's missing here to support a conviction?
A good nexus between the defendant and the methamphetamine. The methamphetamine is in a car not owned by the defendant. It is a car he has been in for only moments or a short period of time. It's in the center console with venue items to Mr. Slavicek. It's in a car that has been seen by the Omaha Police Department on numerous occasions in front of a drug dealer's house, the girlfriend of Ryan Slavicek's. And Officer Holtmeyer also testifies throughout that he had eyes on Mr. De La Torre, and that there was no furtive movement as if to hide or remove methamphetamine that he may have had on his person and place it in the center console. So we have this methamphetamine in a car that Mr. De La Torre has only been in for moments.
What about Slavicek's testimony that De La Torre sold him the drugs?
I think that Mr. Slavicek's testimony is awfully one self-serving after over a year of denying that.
That gets into the credibility that that's outside of our capacity to really do much with.
Well, I think you I think under a case law that the court can look somewhat into the credibility that the jury determined.
I think you'll find very few cases where if a witness credibility is reversed at this level simply because of the fact that they've engaged in criminal conduct in the past.
I think it's true you'll find very few, but that doesn't mean it's not possible. Mr. Slavicek also, and this was something that was not engaged in at trial, Mr. Slavicek also had $2,900 in his pocket on the day he was arrested. So in this particular instance, I believe that the credibility of Mr. Slavicek throughout his testimony and having changed his testimony over time can be looked at by the court. The second possession with intent to deliver is the stop of Mr. Miguel Diaz after exiting the joint building. There's some real incredible testimony in that regard regarding how what he picked up and what went into the car. There's also a lot of incredible, his testimony from the beginning was that Mr. Della Torre had never contacted him to go to the place of employment that day. He was employed by the other owner, and he indicated that the other owner had sent him there. He only changed that story after a year and, or approximately a year, and after being offered numerous inducements by the government to change his story. Again, that took place at a time that Mr. Della Torre's house was being searched for drugs pursuant to a search warrant. He consented to the search of his house. And at that time, he basically had very little opportunity to have contacted anybody to go get drugs out of the house. Again, we have incredible testimony, and we have no nexus between Mr. Della Torre and the drugs as to count three. Then as to count one, the conspiracy count, that primarily runs from the testimony of what we would call another incredible witness, Tammy Gall. Ms. Gall was in federal prison at the time of her testimony in this particular case. She had been a cooperating witness for a while, but had been kicked out of being a cooperating witness. This was because she had resumed taking drugs and failed to contact. And even the DEA agent indicated that, people who get kicked out of cooperating program are generally considered not to be very credible people. She's the only person that testifies basically as to the conspiracy in this case. And the conspiracy is alleged not to be involving her. It's alleged to be involving Mr. Della Torre and his father, who is the only person that she ever dealt with face-to-face, according to her. She dealt with a person she called the friend from the north in a texting situation in order to obtain drugs. If there, in fact, was a conspiracy between Mr. Della Torre and his father to distribute drugs, it's not alleged, and I don't know that Tammy Gall is a co-conspirator in this particular case. At this point, she is simply a buyer for Mr. Della Torre's father. She is not necessarily a co-conspirator. So as far as the conspiracy to distribute 500 or more grams of methamphetamine, only involving basically the testimony of Tammy Gall, I think it fails on both the level of reaching the 500 grams and on the level of a a conspiracy, because a conspiracy is alleged to be only between Marcos De La Torre and his father. His father is alleged to have dealt with her as a buyer only. And so in that particular situation, I think that count fails too. So we have three counts, one where there is no nexus between Mr. De La Torre and the drugs, except the testimony of incredible witnesses, and the third where we have a conspiracy that doesn't exist in effect, or that at least Tammy Gall is not able to tie together. There's some text messages that are brought into evidence. Those text messages are the numbers on those text messages are not tied at all to Mr. De La Torre. These things are unconnected, and then they're all somehow connected by these three incredible witnesses. I raised issues of ineffective assistance of counsel. It's probably not ripe at this time because there are some issues that probably have to be developed in there. If the court determines that that they are not ripe at this time, he needs to bring a future action, we would bring that. With that, I'll reserve the rest.
Thank you, Mr. Pivovar. Mr. Ferretti.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Christopher Ferretti, Assistant U.S. Attorney in this district. I'm representing the appellee. There are five issues presented in this appeal, and as Mr. Pivovar did, I'd address sufficiency of the evidence first. In this case, the evidence at trial was more than sufficient to demonstrate defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. There was, in this case, testimony and evidence from three independent cooperating witnesses, as well as several law enforcement officers, corroborated by other pieces of evidence, such as a drug ledger, a day planner that were items belonging to Tammy Gall. There was a wire that was introduced into evidence worn by Ryan Slavicek, and then there were, of course, the drugs, the methamphetamine that was recovered in the case. The jury heard from two witnesses that got methamphetamine directly from the defendant. Among those witnesses were Ryan Slavicek and Tammy Gall, as Mr. Pivovar indicated. There was the traffic stop that occurred on August 25th, 2014, in which law enforcement recovered 2 ounces of meth from a center console of a vehicle that was driven by Mr. Slavicek. Actually, it was driven by the defendant. Mr. Slavicek was the passenger, but Mr. Slavicek had control of that vehicle. The defendant was present. The defendant had an opportunity to place the methamphetamine in the center console. That evidence was adduced at trial. After that happened, Mr. Slavicek was indicted federally, later cooperated with law enforcement. This is over a year later that he goes back wearing the wire at the request of law enforcement to Mr. De La Torre's shop on 41st and Hamilton Street. And he wears the wire into the shop that was introduced to the jury. There are some, it's not the easiest video to watch. It's very shaky, and the audio is not of the best quality, but there are certainly, upon close listening, one can certainly hear certain admissions by the defendant made. But more importantly, what the wire does is it corroborates the information that Mr. Slavicek is giving to law enforcement about what Mr. De La Torre was up to. Regarding Ms. Gall, she was arrested after an incident or an episode on December 19, 2014. She was involved in a 1.25-ounce methamphetamine deal with the defendant and his father. Defendant's father, also named Marcos De La Torre, was acting as the intermediary and actually physically delivering the meth to Ms. Gall. However, Ms. Gall testified and understood that the methamphetamine came from defendant in this case. So both witnesses, Mr. Slavicek and Ms. Gall, they both had evidence and testified regarding prior methamphetamine transactions with and involving the defendant. The third incident was the July 1st, 2015 law enforcement action, and there was lots of stuff happening on that day. It started with a knock and talk at the defendant's residence. Defendant was on the phone with his brother. Brother was at the residence. Defendant spoke to law enforcement over the phone, gave consent to search the home. It was later determined nothing's found at the residence. However, at the very same time that that's going on, law enforcement is watching defendant's shop at 41st and Hamilton. That's when they observe Mr. Diaz Huizar drive to the shop, get out, go inside, come out carrying an object, get into his car, and drive away. Mr. Diaz's traffic stopped, and the police recover 3/4 of a pound of methamphetamine at that time, plus a scale inside a bag. So Mr. Diaz actually did testify that it was Mr. De La Torre, the defendant, that called him and summoned him to the shop to pick up the item inside. As the court, I think, was inferring, the credibility determinations here are for the jury, and it's pretty clear here that the jury believed the testimony of these three witnesses. And furthermore, the jury verdict may be based solely on the testimony of co-conspirators and cooperating witnesses. And moving to the second issue, which was the items offered as direct evidence of the charged crimes. That's the argument. My argument is that there was no abuse of discretion in denying the defendant's motion in limine and admitting Exhibit 5, which was a tape-recorded conversation between the defendant and Ryan Slavicek, and also Exhibit 17, which consisted of photographs of text messages between the defendant and Tammy Gall. And taking, first and foremost, this evidence was not offered as 404B evidence. It was, again, offered as direct evidence of the charged crimes. The Exhibit 5, the tape-recorded conversation, this was the wire that Mr. Slavicek wore to defendant's shop. That was reviewed in camera by the judge. It was authenticated properly and admitted properly. The McMillan factors were applied. You can see for yourself in the video that it's not easy to watch. It is shaky, but it does contain audio and video. And in addition, Mr. Slavicek, the court properly instructed the jury not to consider the statements of Mr. Slavicek and that they were not to be considered as for the truth of the matter asserted. So that issue was addressed and properly, the judge properly instructed the jury on that issue. Regarding the text messages, those were admitted properly pursuant to Rule 801D2E as statements of a co-conspirator in furtherance of a conspiracy. There was a conspiracy here. There was plenty of testimony regarding multiple sales of resale quantity of drugs, and that is sufficient in and of itself to make a submissible case of conspiracy to distribute narcotics. The charge time frame was broad enough to include the text messages, certainly. One of the defendant's arguments was that the government offered selected text messages and that was prejudicial to do so. Ms. Gall did testify. She was available for cross-examination. The law enforcement officers who retrieved those text messages were also available and testified. I think it was Sergeant Ogurzali that addressed that at trial. Simply put, the evidence, both items of evidence were properly admitted, and there was no abuse of discretion in admitting those items of evidence. Turning to the Speedy Trial Act claim, of course, the defendant must be brought to trial within 70 days of indictment or arraignment. In this case, defendant was indicted in March 2016. He was arraigned on April 6, 2016. At that time, the government moved for detention. The detention hearing was held on the 21st of April. All that time was excluded pursuant to the Speedy Trial Act, Title 18, Section 3161H1H. The Speedy Trial Clock began to run for Mr. De La Torre on April 22, 2016. 4 days later, the defendant filed a motion to extend the motion's deadline, which was granted until May 17, 2016. In that motion, the defendant expressly acknowledges the time would be excluded, and it's the government's position that all the time between April 26, 2016, until the trial order was issued in August, on August 25, 2016, was properly excluded by the court. On August 25, 2016, the court issued the trial order, scheduling the trial for September 27, 2016. And in the ensuing 7 days, when the speedy trial clock was running, there's evidence that the government made inquiries with defendant's counsel regarding their wishes, regarding any potential continuances of trial. The government inquired with the marshals to find out how quickly they could bring Ms. Gall to testify. She was in custody with the Bureau of Prisons in Phoenix. Marshals advised that it would take a minimum of 6 weeks to get her here. The government filed the motion to continue trial on September 1st. That motion was pending until September 6th. When the motion was granted, the court excluded that time pursuant to Title 18, Section 3161H7A, finding that the ends of justice outweigh the best interest of the public and the defendant in a speedy trial. So it's my position that the essentially there was 11 days of speedy trial clock, speedy trial time ran that was not otherwise properly excluded by the time we got to the trial in October. In addition to that, there was another motion filed between the time the continuance of trial was granted and the trial date. The government filed another motion on September 15, 2016 for motion for conflict hearing, and that motion was ruled upon 8 days later on September 22nd, and that time is excludable as well because the motion was pending. And just briefly addressing the final two issues, addressing the motion to suppress, first, the biggest part of this, or the most important thing to realize from the motion to suppress, is the government never actually used anything at trial or offered any evidence obtained during that search at trial. So the notion that the defendant was harmed by this goes nowhere. Essentially, we had a fight over nothing. We had the motion to suppress hearing. It was a four corners of the warrant type hearing. The defendant had a couple of arguments. One was that the warrant should have stated that, or should have specified that there were two separate businesses in this shop, but it did. It did actually say that. It said that it described the location as an auto repair body shop located within a business advertised as Neo's Auto, so the warrant was sufficiently descriptive. And secondly, as I indicated earlier, on July 1st, 2015, as everything's happening at the same time, they do the consent search. They observe Mr. Diaz go to the shop and leave the shop with the methamphetamine. That they're alleging that the warrant should have contained information that nothing was found in Mr. De La Torre's residence. That also goes nowhere because, first and foremost, the timing, but secondly, it's certainly possible that the agent didn't even have the results of that search at the time he sought the search warrant for the business. And finally, as Mr. Pivovar indicated, I don't think the record is sufficiently developed here for ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And even if the court were to consider ineffective assistance of counsel, it would fail under the Strickland versus Washington test. The record speaks for itself. There was certainly vigorous cross-examination of the government's witnesses. The defendant himself testified. There was no especially critical testimony that was overlooked by defense counsel or that they failed to act on. There was no inadmissible devastating evidence that was allowed to go before the jury. He had two attorneys here that were both actively engaged in his defense, and certainly their performance was not such that he wasn't receiving the counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. And unless the court has any additional questions for me, I'd ask the court to affirm the case.
I see none.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ferretti. Mr. Pivovar, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Regarding the tape recording and video recording, I guess, the court's probably seen that. It is very, very difficult to decipher. There are many portions of that that are almost inaudible. Tonal inflections are not able to be drawn for the most part. Some of the audio portions of it are just indecipherable. What's clear is that Mr. Slavicek is there to confront the defendant, as his testimony stated he did on two other occasions. Mr. Dellatore was trying to get him out of his business on that particular occasion. It was a situation where he wanted to defuse what he thought was going to become a violent situation. And in that regard, he did everything. He said anything he could to get Mr. Slavicek out of there. In regards to Tammy Gall, I don't recall any particular testimony where she, in fact, testifies that she dealt directly with Marcus Dellatore, the son, not the father. I don't think there's any incident where she said, there was one incident where she said she was present in a car outside while her boyfriend went in and talked to allegedly Mr. Dellatore Jr. So I don't know that there's any credible testimony. Unless the court has any questions, we would ask that you reverse, please. Thank you.
I see no questions. Thank you, Mr. Pivovar, and thank you also, Mr. Ferretti. The court appreciates your presence in providing argument to the court.